everyone, and welcome to the October episode of Pipettes to Patients, the podcast where science meets compassion and research moves from the bench to the bedside. I'm Dr. Simone, a radiation oncologist and researcher, and in today's episode, I'm so excited to be highlighting the amazing breast cancer research that takes place right here at Upstate Medical University. October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, a time to honor the more than 4 million breast cancer survivors living in the United States today, and to remember that 1 in 8 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer in her lifetime. Each year, over 300,000 new cases are identified, but thanks to early detection and advances in treatment, survival rates have never been higher. In this episode, we'll take a closer look at the people and the progress behind those numbers. From breakthroughs in molecular testing to development of new drugs that target breast cancer in ways we might have never imagined, Dr. Mira Krendel and Dr. Sam Benjamin join me on today's episode to walk us through the current landscape of breast cancer research and treatment. Dr. Krendel is a professor of cell and developmental biology here at Upstate who has always had an interest in cancer research. One of her interests in the lab is looking at how cells move, including breast cancer cells, and exploring changes in what's called their cytoskeleton to understand how cancer cells move outside of the breast. Dr. Benjamin is a medical oncologist who specializes in the treatment of breast cancer. He also focuses on improving outcomes, quality of life, and access to cutting-edge therapies for individuals facing breast cancer. Please listen in with me. I am very excited today to have two guests on who work with breast cancer. October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and I have with me Dr. Sam Benjamin and Dr. Mira Krendel. I'm going to have you guys introduce yourselves. Let us know kind of what your title is here and what you do.
So I'm Dr. Benjamin. I'm the medical oncologist on staff. I really focus on breast cancer a lot. That's my area of focus and interest. I've been here at Upstate for almost 20 years, and I work as part of the multidisciplinary breast cancer program. Enjoy being at Upstate.
Mira? Okay. Yeah, and I'm Mira Krendel, so I'm a professor in the Department of Cell and Developmental Biology. So my lab studies basic cell biology, but we're also interested in how processes that happen in cells affect both breast cancer, other types of cancer, as well as other diseases such as kidney disease.
Very cool. So I want to start with just a general question about, tell me how you guys got to Upstate. What was your kind of, career path and what you love about Upstate?
Sure. So I've been here since 2005. I started out as a very green intern in the internal medicine residency program. And then I stayed on to be an attending, although I did live in Winnipeg, Canada for 2 years as a medical. So it's just where I did my medical oncology fellowship training. And then I came right back. So I've been an attending physician here since 2011. So, I've essentially grew up at Upstate, essentially. Been a great experience. In fact, interestingly enough, I have colleagues that trained with me, including the chief of GI, pulmonary medicine, cardiology. So needless to say, I have everyone on speed dial. So if I need any help with any of the other subspecialties, I'm able to coordinate care very easily. So a lot of advantages of being in a system that you grew up in, sort of. Yep.
And Mira, how did you end up at Upstate?
So I did my PhD at Rutgers University in New York. So I started out in New Jersey and then moved to California for 2 years, worked at the Scripps Research Institute. It was very different. Just the color of the houses was very different, took a bit of getting used to. And then I came back from working at Scripps to do a postdoc at Yale University and kind of felt like the East Coast and Northeast in general was more my speed. And this is where I started working with mouse models of disease and then started at Upstate in 2007. And this really feels like home, both in terms of Syracuse being a really nice place to be and Upstate being this really friendly place where you get to know people and know who to ask for help.
And so you mentioned, working with mouse models of disease. It's really one of the most important things, I think, of basic science, right? Because it's how you sort of do drug development for many diseases. You know, how do you view that step as important in breast cancer research?
There are two steps where you use animal models. And one of them is preclinical research, where you test drugs to see would they actually potentially work in patients, how toxic or non-toxic are they. And of course, animal models are essential there. And then there's what I would consider to be preclinical step. And that's when you have an idea that maybe this gene is important in breast cancer. And we got an idea, for example, for the gene that we work on from a study that someone else did that looked at when this gene is more prevalent or its product is more prevalent in patients with breast cancer, they have worse outcome. And so we just had an idea, what if we get rid of it? How would that affect cancer? And we found out that the mice that lacked this protein had no metastasis, which was extremely dramatic. So I think something like that really helps you test out your initial idea even before you decide whether or not you start developing drugs or whether you want to develop inhibitors. So I think it's an essential step.
Yeah. So I'm going to take a little step back. You obviously mentioned breast cancer metastasis. Dr. Benjamin, can you sort of summarize for us, you know, the natural history of breast cancer and tell us kind of about the different types of breast cancer?
Yeah, breast cancer, you know, starts off as an early disease. And certainly, I think the greatest progress we've made over the last 20 plus years or even longer is the fact that screening mammography and screening protocols we've been able to identify breast cancer early enough before they metastasize. And that has been a great boon for our patients, really. Yet even in the early stage breast cancer, breast cancer is not homogenous. There are different types of breast cancer. We have breast cancers that are predominantly driven by hormones. You have breast cancer that is hormone insensitive. We have breast cancers that have different molecular subtypes that make them more aggressive even within those subtypes. So I think that's where a lot of basic science research has come in being able to identify the subsets within the subsets of and recognizing which patients can develop resistance to endocrine, which is anti-hormonal therapy, and where chemotherapy would actually be beneficial versus majority of those patients may not need chemotherapy, right? So those kind of nuances, I think, thankfully, thanks to progress we've made in basic science so we always talk about bench to bedside, you know, research, and that's been really transformative, especially in breast cancer. And honestly, breast cancer is sort of the pioneering disease site starting with Dr. Bernard Fisher, we're talking about almost 40 years ago, showed that administering chemotherapy post-surgery can actually cure patients that would have otherwise had recurrence. And eventually we were able to carry that forward to other disease sites. So breast cancer has really been sort of a driving force in terms of being able for innovation and progress.
The care of breast cancer patients is certainly very multidisciplinary. Usually starts with surgery, right, when you're talking about an early stage breast cancer patient. What is your role sort of in those patients, in that patient population? So they have their surgery, they maybe have radiation, and then where do you come in?
So certainly, you know, I even explained to my patients that we tend to now approach most cancers, including breast cancer, in a multidisciplinary fashion. So yes, there's surgical oncology, there's medical oncology, which I'm involved with, and then there's radiation oncology. Certainly, there are subsets of patients that do benefit from upfront systemic treatment prior to surgery. So identifying those patients and versus those who can do very well going straight to surgery. So that's part of what we do in a multidisciplinary setting, is to identify those patients that need treatment upfront in terms of systemic treatment, whether it's hormonal or chemo or other, you know, or targeted therapy before surgery versus those who will benefit from it afterwards. So I think a multidisciplinary approach is certainly the key to getting the best patient outcomes. Yep.
You know, when I think about breast cancer, obviously, you know, there are different subtypes that we sort of talked about. The patients that have estrogen and progesterone receptor positive disease, right? Those, we call them luminal A, right? Breast cancers. Those are the breast cancers that we think are going to behave well, right? But I think that these new genetic, you know, testing mechanisms have really kind of shed some light on maybe there are subpopulations of patients even within the luminal A's that are not going to behave like the rest.
Yeah. And so we, and you know, that's where we actually have even patients enrolled on clinical trials. So, so for example, here at Upstate, we have been a huge participant in the FLEX registration study, which uses a commercially available genomic risk assay called MammaPrint to identify high risk versus low risk patients. And essentially what we're doing is even prior to surgery, when we have a biopsy specimen available, we are able to test the tumor and look at the 70 gene signature assay and identify which are those patients that have, say, luminal A, hormone sensitive of patients where those patients are going to do quite well for most part without chemotherapy versus say a high risk patient with a basal subtype where, which is a particular molecular subtype that would benefit from upfront treatment. In fact, we even have a complementary clinical trial where if the FLEX study identifies patients with a very high risk subtype, they can go on a clinical trial where we are investigating the use of immunotherapy as part of the protocol to administer with chemo prior to surgery in the high risk patient. So this is where I think having a multidisciplinary team, being able to see patients using different facets and just being able to identify patients and enroll them on clinical trials is such a key thing for us.
And that's sort of, you know, the MammaPrint, as you mentioned, you know, it sort of speaks to what Mira was talking about with, you know, you obviously were able to get an idea based on this genetic, right, mutation that you noticed that patients with that particular mutation did worse overall. So tell me a little bit more about myosin and how it works and why it's important in breast cancer.
Right. So we didn't know at first that it was important in breast cancer, but in general, myosins are, we call them molecular motors, so molecular machines. So they're basically proteins that move things inside the cells. And if you think of our cells also can move. And so they have this bone-like skeleton. We call it cytoskeleton or cellular skeleton, cytoskeleton. And it's composed of protein fibers. And then you have myosin motors that zoom around on these protein fibers and either move things or help cells change their shape by moving the fibers relative to each other. So normally, if everything works well, these myosins and cytoskeleton play an important role in normal cellular functions. But if that system is off balance, then the cells might start moving when we don't want them to move, and they can invade surrounding tissues. So if we are talking about tumor cells, they might enter the bloodstream and then spread to other sites, and then you end up with tumor metastasis in the lungs or the brain or the bones, which is what we don't want to happen. And so where we started was actually getting rid of this myosin and finding out that it's important in kidney function. So our mice that lack this myosin actually develop kidney disease. And there are patients who have mutations in the gene that codes for this myosin, and they also get kidney disease. But then we read this study that said if you have too much of this myosin in tumor samples, tumor cells, then the patient might have poor prognosis. And so we decided to see what happens if you have no myosin, what would happen to breast cancer. So we took these mice that reliably develop breast cancer because they have an oncogene in their memory gland cells, and found out that when this myosin was missing, we call it myosin 1E or MYO1E, they had absolutely no metastasis, and their tumors looked a lot more like normal breast tissue rather than tumors. And so clearly it somehow is important, leading to this abnormal movements and invasion in the tumor cells.
Do you think that particular gene could potentially be a therapeutic intervention for breast cancer patients?
So that's the hope, because myosins are enzymes. So enzymes are molecules that can usually be inhibited by drugs. So that's why we think it could be a good target. And also there are people who have persuaded that they could become part of a signature similar to what we were talking about with Mama Prince, or could be a signature that's used to determine which cancers are more aggressive or have poor prognosis.
Very cool. I want to go back also to the immunotherapy comment that you made, because immunotherapy is obviously very hot right now. Everybody loves to talk about it. They have commercials on TV for immunotherapy. So how has immunotherapy made its way into breast cancer?
So immunotherapy is actually a relative latecomer to breast cancer relative to some other disease sites, other diseases like lung cancer, and melanoma and kidney cancer. In fact, for a long time, we really didn't know what the role of immunotherapy would be until we recognized that there are a certain subset of patients with certain type of breast cancer, essentially triple negative breast cancer, that have a certain immunogenic signature, which can be measured, that do benefit from with the addition of immunotherapy to cytotoxic chemo. You know, so going back to the MammaPrint and the FLEX study and this clinical trial we have, which identifies a subset of patients that have now hormone sensitive breast cancer, but a certain subtype that has been shown in early phase studies to be highly responsive, not just to upfront chemotherapy, but actually the addition of immunotherapy. So we are going beyond the triple negative space and identifying patients with that have hormone-driven breast cancer that have a certain molecular subtype that may also benefit from immunotherapy. And that's what our clinical trial is looking at. Interestingly enough, we've gone beyond even immunotherapy, and now we're talking about what we call ADCs, which are antibody-drug conjugates. Very soon, pending FDA approval, we will be likely using immunotherapy in conjunction with an ADC called Trodelvy as first-line treatment in triple negative metastatic breast cancer, which essentially means that we won't be using chemo up front, which is quite an progress. Yeah. So historically, triple negative breast cancer has been sort of the most challenging space for treatment of breast cancer, both in terms of providing curative intent treatment as well as treatments that are effective in the metastatic space. So I think the advances we are making with antibody drug conjugates that essentially are drugs that bind to certain receptors or markers on the cells to deliver a highly toxic chemo specific smartly into the cells, and essentially that's what it does, has been the next sort of frontier of where we are at.
To me, that's a very crazy concept to even hear the words that, you know, triple negative breast cancer patients are not going to get upfront necessarily chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. I mean, Taxol was, you know, remember when that was the big
Taxol,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, that was the biggest thing that made a huge survival impact for those patients.
Yeah.
So it's crazy that we've kind of come
in
that
fact,
far.
They just came out with the data for a study where even patients that may not get immunotherapy but actually could get an ADC first line versus, and they perform better than regular chemotherapy. So yeah, we're coming a long way. And obviously we haven't even gone into subsets of patients that have certain mutations like BRCA1 and 2 mutations that can be that can benefit from targeted therapies too. So yeah, we've come a long way.
So we talked about immunotherapy. And one of the things that I wanted to sort of ask is, obviously, there's certain tumors that respond well to immunotherapy and some that don't. And they sort of, people have termed it hot and cold, right? So I think if you have a higher number of like tumor infiltrating lymphocytes, mm-hmm. right? Those are lymphocytes that kind of can make their way into the tumor. You may have a better response, right? And that's one of the things I actually wanted to ask Dr. Krendel, if, you know, if myosin plays a role in terms of like the immune cells infiltrating into breast cancer?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So this myosin is highly prevalent in immune cells. It's involved in immune cell migration. And what we did find in our mouse model was that in the mice that lack this myosin, there are actually fewer infiltrating immune cells in the tumors. So that might make it a little bit more challenging, it sounds like, to apply something like immunotherapy.
Yeah, interesting. So, yeah, I was just curious, you know, because, again, even with radiation, we're learning now that, you know, trying to give concurrent immunotherapy maybe is not the right thing with radiation for some tumors, because mm-hmm. we kill off some of the immune cells that are within the tumor microenvironment with radiation.
Right.
So I think we still have a long way to go in yeah. terms of learning.
So turning, that's really the holy grail for immunotherapy, is turning what we call cold tumors into hot tumors, really. Tumors that are not going to respond, and how do we make those respond? And certainly in cross-disease sites, we found that using combining cytotoxic chemotherapy with immunotherapy certainly can be effective. And so, taking a page from certainly from bladder cancer, that's another site where we've actually now do combine an ADC with immunotherapy as first line treatment, and it's relegated chemo to, you know, second or third line. So essentially, you know, I think where I see immunotherapy being more widely used is going to be in those tumors which are not, which are cold tumors, but can be converted, can benefit from combining with ADCs.
Now, the model that you work with, Mira, the mouse model that they sort of spontaneously develop breast tumors, are those triple negative breast tumors? Are they?
I think they are basal-like.
Okay.
So I don't think they're I don't think they're triple negative. They usually have some hormone receptor expression.
Gotcha.
We also have worked with a cell culture model that is a triple negative mouse cancer cell line. And what we find in that model is that when there's no myosin 1E in those cells, they don't invade as much. So this is sort of taking a step back. It's not in mice, it's in cells,
sure.
in a dish, but yeah. it seems like there's also an effect in triple negative.
Mm-hmm. You know, obviously, there's also an idea of using, you know, tumor xenografts, right, where you actually take a patient's tumor and grow it on a mouse that doesn't have an immune system. What do you sort of view as the advantages to that versus this sort of model that spontaneously develops tumors?
Yeah, so I always think it's the best case scenario. One of the people I kind of learned from in the kidney disease field used to say every patient should have a mouse running somewhere that represents their disease, or a zebrafish swimming somewhere that represents their disease, or at least a worm crawling somewhere that has the same mutation that they have. So I think the same can apply to cancer. So it's nice to have what they call patient avatars. So in other words, you take a patient tumor sample and you somehow graft it into a mouse model or some other animal model, or grow it in the lab so that you can find out which drugs would work best on that model. And I think where things are going right now, and what we are also interested in, is maybe skipping the step with animal models and being able to recreate patient tissue, patient tumor sample in the lab without having to use animals, so that you can have three-dimensional structure that kind of looks like a patient tumor, and then you can add different drugs and see what happens, which drugs would work best. So I think that would be ideal.
Yes, that's very cool. Do you guys do some of that in your lab?
Yeah, so what we are working on actually is right now we're working on developing a model for kidney on a chip. So we collaborate with bioengineers over at Syracuse University, and they make this models out of basically biological inks that will have channels just like blood vessels or some other parts of the body. And so one can grow cells that would normally cover blood vessels, for example. And ideally, you would add tumor cells to that model and basically have this little tumor on a chip. And then you could pump the drugs through the bloodstream and see what happens.
That's interesting. Okay, we've talked a lot about science, but we haven't talked a lot about why you both decided to do what you do. So obviously you must love it because you're here every day. Mm-hmm. So Dr. Benjamin, why did you decide to become a medical oncologist?
Yeah, so, you know, I think I developed an interest in oncology early on in my medical school training itself because of exposure to cancer patients. Certainly there was a personal connection because in my early part of my medical school years, my grandfather actually was diagnosed with esophageal cancer. Unfortunately, he passed away from it. And so that sort of was one sort of, you know, incentive to go to explore the field. I think what I really appreciate in being an oncologist is the opportunity to really develop relationships with patients. And it's a one-of-a-kind relationship that has its challenges, but I think it also is fulfilling, you know.
Dr. Crandall, why did you decide to, you know, obviously I think a lot of your research focuses on kidney, but, you know, why cancer?
So actually, when I was an undergraduate student, I did a research project at the Moscow Cancer Center, and it was a lab that was called the Laboratory of Mechanism of Carcinogenesis. So they were studying very fundamental processes, basically what happens to normal cells so that they suddenly become cancer cells. And what was really interesting was these fundamental questions were very exciting. And then there would be people in the lab who were actually developing diagnostic tests so that they could stain tumors for different types of cytoskeletal fibers to determine where did these tumors come from and what their properties were. So from that point on, I was really interested in that intersection of what can you do to find out how things happen and then how can you apply them to help patients. Mm. So actually cancer was sort of my original place of origin that I was interested in, and also the work that I did in graduate school was mostly about cancer cells. So I keep coming back to this question of what happens, why does a normal cell suddenly change and start moving around and doing these things that we don't want it to do.
What advice would you give to students or mentees, you know, people who are looking to sort of get into the field of cancer research or, you know, oncology in general? What do you think one piece of kind of advice is for those people?
If you think you are the field of oncology interests you, then I would say that choose to expose yourself to the field, either by looking for opportunities to volunteer, to work in a lab, to shadow a physician, for example, just to see if that's something you really are geared towards, you know. It's the same advice I give to my kids, especially my 10th grader. It's like my 10th grader volunteered at the hospital this summer, and in spite of her trying to avoid it, she was actually volunteering in the oncology ward of the Krauss Hospital, and she found it the most depressing place to be, because she would rather have been in the neonatal ward or whatever, okay. Right? And so obviously, everyone's temperament is different, you know. But certainly I would say that if you think, number one, does the science of oncology interest you? Does the patient-facing aspect of that interest you?
And?
Yeah, so I have very similar advice, because I think there are a lot of paths one can take after, let's say, you do maybe a graduate degree study. And I think people should figure out what a day-to-day life would look like. For example, people might be interested in science, but they might not want to do very tedious, very repetitive experiments in the lab. But maybe they want to spend time talking to patients. So I've had students from my lab who graduated and went on to become clinical research coordinators. And that works really well for them. Or they stay in science, or they go into pharma or biotech companies, because there the pace of discovery is much faster probably than in fundamental science. So you can feel like you are making a difference, you're discovering new drugs quickly. And then some people go to medicine and oncology after studying the more basic questions. So I think you should try out, figure out what your actual day-to-day life would look like with all of these different career paths.
What do you think is one thing that's sort of, you know, I obviously alluded to the fact that you both like it here at Upstate. What do you think is one, you know, because we're a smaller institution, but what do you think is one potential sort of benefit to being at a smaller institution in terms of research, productivity, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think I've certainly benefited from being part of a small institution is the fact that it's actually easier to access expertise in different fields, especially when dealing with a disease that is certainly very multidisciplinary. I think I found it easier, believe it or not, to open clinical trials, okay, because you're not competing with multiple different needs. And so I think we are very fortunate in that we do have an excellent infrastructure for basic science and clinical research. I think that's a real advantage of a program our size. Plus, I think for our trainees, whether we're talking about medical students or residents or fellows, there's certainly many opportunities that they can take advantage of that you might not actually have those opportunities in a very large institution, or you can essentially get lost in a bigger institution.
So I would say the same on the research side. There's more collaboration, less competition. It's easier to get things done. Mm-hmm. And the research infrastructure, as you said, is really good and it's shared. So I think it's a very efficient way of using the resources. So if you have expensive instruments, then they are shared or used by multiple people. And it's also easy to find experts if you need advice on something. So I think it's really this collaborative environment that's a big strength.
You, Dr. Krendel, you've also, you know, you have kind of an extensive CV when it comes to mentoring students and, you know, graduate students, et cetera, in your lab. What do you think is beneficial for students here doing research at Upstate?
So I think getting access to experts in different fields, other departments is very easy because we all know each other. We know what other people are working on. We can ask someone for help in mentoring students. We have a very good structured program in terms of students having advisory committees and getting regular meetings and advice from researchers in other fields. And getting access even to high-level administrators and research, if someone wants to go and talk to the VP for research, for example, and find out how to develop towards their next steps, the people are very willing to meet and support both students and postdocs and other trainees.
Okay, so last question. I'll have to frame it differently for both of you. But Dr. Benjamin, do you have any sort of one particular interaction with a patient that kind of sticks out to you, or anything in your mind that you think about, you know, that was very gratifying for you?
Yeah, that's a tough one.
You love all your patients,
sure.
But
certainly the ones that stand out the most are the most challenging scenarios, right? Certainly for me as a medical oncologist, the most challenging conversations are certainly end of life. And having those conversations in the context of having a relationship is very important, because I think the continuity of care that we have with our patients allow us to be, quite frankly, honest and upfront about prognosis and treatment limitations. It's hard to really pinpoint, because I've had so many of these conversations mm-hmm. over the years, they're all unique, yet they all have the same element where, you know, you're trying to communicate what you want to communicate with compassion, but just be truthful and honest upfront about what we're doing. I think really it's meeting the patient where they're at in terms of their overarching goal, right? I mean, if it's to make it to the next big holiday or be able to be around to see their son or daughter get married. These are sort of the goalposts that we try to achieve, but oftentimes it may not be achievable. So I think it's really individual, you know. But it's, at the same time, I would say as challenging as it is, it's also fulfilling, because you get to really be part of your patient's life.
And Mira, what do you think, you know, what are some of the more gratifying things that you glean from your work every day? I mean, obviously, you know, on the first episode of this podcast, we talked a lot about grant rejections, which are hard and inevitable, but, you know, there are wins that we get. So what are some of the things that, you know, you really enjoy about your job?
So actually, the first thing I will mention is a patient encounter, which is kind of related to what we just talked about. So I review a lot of research grants. And on some grant panels, you have patient advocates mm-hmm. who are either, so for example, when I was reviewing grants related to breast cancer, there were either breast cancer survivors or patients with metastatic breast cancer who were still going through treatment but were sort of in remission, or at least in between treatments. And that was one of the most inspirational interactions I've had, because they were all extremely engaged. They felt that research was what would offer hope to either them or other patients like them. They were very knowledgeable, and they would also tell us, this is what's important for patients. This is what's important for our quality of life. This is where current drugs don't work. So I would say that was one of the really inspirational encounters. And whenever I interact with patients, I feel like whatever we do in the lab, however small, is sort of helpful to others. But then also training students, of course, and seeing them succeed is really good. And then occasionally you get that little win, you get a grant. And I always think of Sally Fields when, at Oscars, when she says, they like me, they really like me. So that's just, okay, well, finally they liked something that I wrote. So yeah, there are lots of little wins.
All right. Well, I thank you guys so much for participating. It's been fun. I've learned a bunch, and I can't wait to reconvene maybe next year. Thank you for joining us for this special breast cancer awareness episode of Pipettes to Patients. I'd like to thank our guests for participating in the conversation and sharing their expertise. These sessions always remind me that progress in cancer care happens when science and compassion come together. As we reflect on the millions of women and men affected by breast cancer, let's remember that awareness is just the beginning. Dr. Benjamin made an excellent point that I want to highlight, and that was that breast cancer research is currently the benchmark for other types of cancer. And a lot of that has to do with the awareness that we as a society have been able to raise. It's through research, advocacy, and community that we continue to make strides toward earlier detection, better therapies, and ultimately prevention. For support, resources, or information on clinical trials, or even ways to get involved, please visit trusted sources like the American Cancer Society, the National Cancer Institute, or clinicaltrials.gov. If you're interested in getting more information about the cancer care offered at Upstate, please visit the Cancer Center website at www.upstate.edu/cancer. Additionally, you can pop over to the Cancer Research website at www.upstate.edu/cancer/research if you're interested in learning more about the current breast cancer research happening right here at Upstate. If you enjoyed listening today, don't forget to follow us wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you for joining us on Pipettes to Patients, where every discovery brings us one step closer to hope. Until next time, stay informed and stay empowered.